Divided Kingdom, the evening news program with a Christian viewpoint that many of you have come to know and trust. This is Elizabeth Cuppock Caberly, and Lou Caberly will be with us a little bit later in the program. We've been talking about the growing depravity in this country, and we've been talking about The Harbinger, the book by Pastor Jonathan Kahn that related things that happened in ancient Israel before judgment to things that are occurring here in the United States after the events of September 11th. Some of the things were the pride, the spirit of pride and hubris, as some of our leaders unwittingly spoke those same words of prophecy from Isaiah 9:10. They would rebuild better than ever, and they would change the type of tree that God had planted there. We would have things so ever much better, and now that we see that the Washington Monument has been reconstructed, but we have to remember, listeners, don't we, that there was debris inside and outside of it, and there was a lot of damage high up. Symbolically, we can see that this represents the corruption of the spiritual soul of America. And in Revelation, there's that gigantic cup that's filling and filling and filling till God can no longer stand the stench of it. So it looks to us here as though we're under kind of a pre-judgment period in which God is holding his arms out. You recall when I read to you those verses, those of you who heard our program, that passage of Isaiah 9:10 and going on to verse 11 that talked about the foreign invasions and on still farther as God kept stretching his hands out, not enough penance, not enough remorse. The hands of judgment just kept stretching out more and more until the tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim were there. We're all going to be accountable. And, you know, Condoleezza Rice said something interesting, but I think she doesn't realize it could be taken spiritually instead of the political reasoning she had. She said, and this was quoted in Time magazine, "When America steps back, trouble will fill that vacuum." And they comment there in Time magazine that she was alleging that America's, quote, weariness over foreign entanglements enabled Vladimir Putin's land grab in Crimea, among other diplomatic crises. Well, we know, those of us who listen to alternative patriot talk and who read websites like Matt Drudge and InfoWars, that the U.S. is far from playing a passive role over there in the Ukraine. We've heard that Vice President Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, has now received a job there in the Ukraine, some type of a job. And I think it might relate to oil. I'm not certain about that. But we know that NATO and the European Union really want to get a hold of the Ukraine. They want it to come in under their jurisdiction. All over the world, anywhere where there is a commodity or something that will please men of greed, like Africa, the whole dark continent. It isn't dark very much now. It's lit up with all of these fake jihadis and some that are real. The Islamic movement against the Christians. All of this, there's a part that is very real. Satan hates Christians. Satan hates Christianity. So he's certainly going to use this Islamic Quran, all of the things that say in it to kill the infidels. He's going to use that. Satan's going to use that. But at the same time, man's heart is desperately wicked. So we want to get a lot of things that are there in Africa. So we have to watch this situation that we talked about that is so questionable with the 300 girls taken. Is it a CIA-backed episode? We don't know for certain. But when Condoleezza Rice said these words, "When America steps back, trouble will fill that vacuum," we might say that when America's churches step back and when they say nothing as prayer is taken out of the schools at the behest of Madeleine Murray O'Hare, the avowed atheist who died a strange death, we hear. You see, we are not blessed if we go against God Almighty. Not in the long run. God has the final say over each of our lives. And then 1973, Roe versus Wade. the abortion, the terrible, terrible hegemony of Satan over our country, bringing the culture of death nearer and nearer to all of our lives. The Vietnam War, you see, with the drugs coming in here. Yes, in the Ladies Home Journal this month, there is a moving essay by a mother whose daughter was a star student, never gave her any trouble, but there was a great life change when her husband suddenly died, unexpectedly, and the whole family was plunged into turmoil, both financial and emotional. There were young children, and this teenage girl, the mother thinks perhaps that was the beginning, but the ending was the mother having to throw the girl and her live-in boyfriend in her bedroom out of the home. All of the things that the mother broke into the room and found the syringes and all of the filth and all of the troubling things that were connected with the heroin, and she threw them out the window. And she didn't see her daughter again for about 2 years. And the mother, of course, worried, worried, worried. Had she done the wrong thing? But she had to save her younger children. Finally, there is a happy ending. The girl resurfaced by calling her mother, and she said, "I've had enough. I want to get clean." So we do want to pray for that situation, that it continues to be good. And the mother said she at first blamed God for her all of these things happening. And then she blamed herself, the guilt. But the daughter said recently to her, "You had to do what you had to do, because someone has to get to the bottom before they really want to change." And I think that's true of all of us. Some of us never realized we were sinners. I know I didn't till in the 1990s. Not really. I was little Miss Pious, Sunday school teacher, Sunday school pianist, church pianist, all of these things that I did for children and for grown-ups too. I was my mother's assistant anytime she had her women's group from the church there. All of these things. But they didn't really make me born again. It was only when I saw my deep sins and realized, yes, some people had wronged me in life, but we're all wronged. People are just not perfectly okay. None of us is okay. We have good days, we have bad days. We have inconsistencies. This is what it means to be human. But much greater than that, once the Western civilization markers are taken away, and largely that is our belief in Jesus Christ, in our culture too. Once those things have been removed, remember Al Cuppet said, "Remove not the ancient landmarks." It's much easier now to see this pratfall downwards, the celebrity culture. I thought perhaps Lou and I would watch The Bachelorette. I really looked forward to this, because it hadn't been too depraved, and at least it was a woman seeking a man and a man seeking a woman. Then I had heard that one of the applicants to be the husband of the bachelorette had died suddenly, and it was very tragic. And I thought, well, I didn't know whether I wanted to watch it if he was shown all throughout the long series, and then we had to really see how sad this was. But, you know, when I picked up the TV guide today, I realized another separation has come. During the first episode, the eligible men are going to strip naked for charity. Now, I don't think they'll actually show all full frontal nudity, but the idea that we're going to do that in the first episode and it's supposedly going to benefit charity, this is depraved. And I realize it's not the worst thing that I've seen on television, but it is corrupt. So, you know, I just really don't want this anymore. There are other things that I have to do with my life in the time that is given to me. You know, there are lots of good books. There are Bible verses that I really want to read. But we can see what's happening. Let's just get a little snapshot of the cup filling up. Now, I think two things are happening. The abominations are increasing. The liquid in the cup is rising, rising. So at the same time, some judgment is falling, so that we not only see the hubris and the devil-may-care, and I guess I mean that literally, attitude of these celebrities. They don't realize anything about the judgment. But the ordinary people are beginning to feel the judgment. The ones who don't have all the millions of dollars that these celebrities have, they're beginning to hurt. So we're seeing the police state clamp down more and more. We're seeing lots of repercussions from Obamacare. So let's just first see what's going on in the celebrity culture. Oprah Winfrey has a new Sunday morning meditation program. So any of you who got fed up with the emerging churches and the large screens and all of the things that don't really pertain to Scripture, you might find it interesting to tune in Oprah. In the July Good Housekeeping magazine, there was an actress, I think she's the lead actress in Parenthood, and they asked her a question. Person with whom you'd most like to trade places for a day with? Jay-Z, I want to see what it's like being married to Beyoncé. Oops, did I hear that right? I would have thought she would have said she wanted to trade places with Beyoncé to see what it was like being married to Jay-Z. No, not in this kind of world we're in now. Then we next have Heidi Klum. Heidi Klum on America's Got Talent. This is from TV Guide, and it says, the headline, "We go a little loopy." So says Heidi Klum as she and her fellow judges once again get starstruck on America's Got Talent. And I'll just quote, I think you can get the full impression of this without too much commentary from me. It's the first day of America's Got Talent auditions in Hollywood's Dolby Theater, and the circus has come to town. An 8-year-old boy throws knives at and around his father. A drum-dance hybrid group named Street Beat rhythmically slams dozens of garbage cans. But it's a soccer-playing pig named Mudslinger that makes the crowd go hog wild, especially when Judge Heidi Klum jumps on stage for a kiss. The pig wants you to bend over, and so does every pig in the audience, quips fellow panelist Howie Mandel before Klum plants a wet one on the swine. Isn't it great, marvels Howard Stern, as he gathers with Klum, Mandel, and Judge Mel B backstage during a break. We actually appreciate so many different kinds of talent. There's no category, even a kook category, that's given short shrift. And even though the NBC reality competition is entering its 9th season, the judges all agree the talent has never been stronger. There were certain programs that were reporting on some large corporations being connected with putting out handbooks on bestiality. We're getting closer and closer to a kind of world that I fear you and I and Lou and others of our generation could never, never imagine. We're just going at light warp speed. TV Guide's cover feature was A Modern Family Wedding. Now, though this was said to be the favorite program of ex-presidential candidate Mitt Romney and his wife Ann, Lou and I have never watched this program. But it says, A Modern Family Wedding, exclusive inside Mitch and Cam's big day. And it says, we do. And each of the men has his finger in his mouth. He's been licking the cake, like a little boy would do when his mother bakes a birthday cake. So we look in at this a little bit. And what they say about it is, after 5 seasons and a real-life court ruling, Modern Family's Cam and Mitch finally exchange vows. We're on set exclusively for the celebration. This was written by Rob Moynihan. Modern Family cordially invites you to the wedding of Mitchell Vincent Pritchett, Jesse Tyler Ferguson, and Cameron Scott Tucker, Eric Stone Street. On May 21st, the Emmy-winning ABC sitcom's harried fathers are set to make it official in a momentous, highly anticipated ceremony. That is, if they can get there. Family drama, wildfires, a runaway bride, and a closed dry cleaner all threaten to derail the festivities before they ever get started. Now, the next is a very interesting comment. It's very ironic. Things go wrong on a biblical scale, says executive producer Christopher Lloyd, during a break in filming on location at Trump National Golf Club in Rancho Palos Verdes, California. Quote, it's to the point where Mitch and Cam start to wonder if there are powers greater than all of them in the family that do not want the two to get married. We might ask that, too. Are there powers they least suspect there? Judgment powers? The article says, in reality, the producers faced their own gargantuan obstacle when it came to crafting the season-long arc. In 2008, voters in California passed a controversial Proposition 8, an amendment to the state's constitution that prohibited same-sex marriages from being recognized. Nobody wanted Cam and Mitch to leave their home state to tie the knot. So when the United States Supreme Court began to review the legality of the amendment in March 2013, the Modern Family Writers Room was abuzz with ideas. We got so excited about it. We started breaking stories before even the thing was defeated, says writer and executive producer Jeffrey Richmond. When Prop 8 was overturned on June 26, 2013, quote, it was extremely emotional for all of us, Richmond says. Quote, it's this thing that 9 years ago, when Cam and Mitch met, they didn't imagine could happen. And we might interject, we didn't imagine things would go this quickly either. Are the portals of evil opening wider and wider? But the article says, the straight couples on the show are married and take it completely for granted. Cam and Mitch's relationship has always been recognized, but never in the same way. The significance of the two-party vent is also deeply personal to the show's stars. For a lot of people in America, this will be the first gay wedding that they ever get to attend, says Ferguson, who married lawyer Justin Makita in New York City last July. I have a lot of friends who have been together even longer than Mitch and Cam, and they are finally able to exchange vows, so it is very poignant and meaningful to me to be able to bring this relationship into so many living rooms and also into the pop culture zeitgeist. Oh, God help us. God help us in this time that we are now living in. We do need His help. There's been a little bit of good news before we get to some of the things that are going on. The U.S. Supreme Court rules in favor of prayer at public gatherings. This is from Friday Church News Notes. In what should have been a unanimous decision, a slim majority of Supreme Court justices, 5-4. Now, isn't that ominous right there? We just made it through by one person. Ruled that a town's practice of starting legislative sessions with prayer does not violate the First Amendment, and those prayers can even include the name of Jesus Christ. This is a welcome pushback against secular activists who have sought to forbid prayers mentioning Christ and who desire freedom from being, quote, offended. Writing for the majority, Anthony Kennedy observed that the U.S. Congress appointed chaplains just days after approving the First Amendment, so it is obvious that the Establishment Clause does not forbid such a thing. He wrote, an insistence on non-sectarian or ecumenical prayer as a single fixed standard is not consistent with the tradition of legislative prayer outlined in the court's case. The Congress that drafted the First Amendment would have been accustomed to invocations containing explicitly religious themes. And we interject again from the book, The Harbinger. Lou Caverly read to you from that the first people who convened under George Washington, before they did anything else, they walked down the street to St. Paul's, the little church. They walked really right over ground zero to get there to pray. So absolutely, they were not praying to Allah. They were praying to Jesus Christ. So David Cloud at the Way of Life, Friday Church News Notes, continues what Anthony Kennedy, who wrote for the majority, said. The decidedly Christian nature of these prayers must not be dismissed as the relic of a time when our nation was less pluralistic than it is today. Congress continues to permit its appointed and visiting chaplains to express themselves in a religious idiom. It acknowledges our growing diversity not by prescribing sectarian content, but by welcoming ministers of many creeds. Kennedy said that offense does not equate coercion. Dismissing atheists' arguments that they are offended by Christian prayers. All of that is well and good, but at the same time, now this is David Cloud's opinion, four dissenting Supreme Court justices would have forbidden explicitly Christian prayers, and even Kennedy said there are limits to what can be said in prayer, specifically singling out prayers that threaten damnation or preach conversion. The only true friends of religious liberty on the court are Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia, both of whom thought that Kennedy did not go broadly enough in support of prayer. Now, as this cup of abomination fills further and further and further, and the homosexual lifestyle is adopted more and more and more in the churches of America, legitimized, never scrutinized to see about the well-being of the children over time who have been sacrificed, who will not have the role models of a mother and a father, a woman and a man. No, we're going to be moving this at light warp speed. So as that all comes, I would foresee the time when the Supreme Court justices will go further on the limits. Right now, prayers that threaten damnation or preach conversion are off limits, but we can envision the types of prayers and thinking that will be off limits. There will be more hate crimes legislation. There will be a lot more coming, we fear, as judgment nears this nation. But there was a locality near us. That was a little redundant. Lou, can you remember where it was? Welcome to the program, Lou.
Oh, good to be here. I believe it was Carroll County.
I believe it was.
Which is northwest of Baltimore City.
And it was a local town, wasn't it, in their town meetings.
I think it was.
And they had been beset by someone who had moved in, a newcomer, an atheist type, who really did not want God mentioned. And so there was another, so they're going back to using the name of Jesus. But we're looking here at another editorial viewpoint from the Colorado Springs Gazette. Apparently, there was another case that triggered this. It says, the court ruled 5-4 in favor of the town of Greece, New York, which was sued by two women because town leaders consistently began meetings with Christian prayers that invoked Jesus and God. Susan Galloway and Linda Stevens, a Jew and an atheist, respectively, argued the prayers are unconstitutional because people in attendance may feel pressured to participate. So we see that the First Amendment was defended. Now, Lou, before you came, I was giving a little rundown on the TV guide that you have not seen yet. You knew that I had told you about the lead actress of the program Parenthood saying that she wished she could be in Jay-Z's shoes for
yes.
a while in his marriage so she'd
right.
know what it was like to be with Beyoncé.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't realize we're having a Modern Family wedding. Look at the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And so I read a lot about that, and they had a lot of what they called so-called biblical-style interruptions. Things went wrong on a biblical scale, said the executive producer. And it was to the point that Mitch and Cam, quote, start to wonder if there are powers greater than all of them in the family that do not want the two to get married.
Hmm.
Is God's judgment nearing? We really do wonder. And then Heidi Klum on her program, America's Got Talent. This was rather shocking. It looks as though it's symbolic of bestiality. They had her go up on stage and give what they call a wet kiss to this pig.
Mm.
Now, the pig was named something, too, I think. Yes, Mudslinger.
Oh.
And Howard Stern said, isn't it great? He loved this. He loved seeing this. But we've heard about, well, I don't want to name it because we haven't corroborated it. But there was at least one large shopping chain, a store that you and I have frequented for appliances and things, said to have put out a manual on bestiality. Do you remember that on talk radio, Alternative Patriot talk radio?
I do remember that, yes.
Yeah, so if that is the truth, it really is horrible. And we see here intimations of things that we think are coming. Now, along with that, I said to the listeners before you arrived that we would see not only this increase in depravity. Oh, and I have to tell you, there won't be any bachelorette. Sorry, honey.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah. I looked at the opening program,
mm-hmm.
and we have the eligible men, stripping for charity. And I thought, that's it. Do you agree with me?
Yep.
Not that that's the worst kind of depravity we might see, because we know they'll have to be somewhat tasteful, not show everything on television yet.
Yes, that's true.
But the idea that we're going to do something so twisted and corrupt and pornographic in order to get this girl a husband is twisted and depraved and sick. It's not Christian. And I realize the time has come. What do you think?
I think my husband. Right. I think you're just right. It has come. The time has come.
Are you kind of fed up that we hardly get to watch any television?
Yeah. There are very, very few good shows on, what we would consider wholesome, enlightening, uplifting. There are some good things on the public television. There are occasional things, if you really look hard enough, and of course there are good reruns of old-fashioned
movies. But you know, even there, and you can't constantly approve of PBS. We've seen things on there we had to turn off, too. Some British so-called comedies that were depraved. A lot of things are depraved. Look at all the witch-type sitcom. No, I don't mean sitcom. Witch-type dramas and little romantic comedies on Hallmark. And they're usually at times like Easter or Resurrection Day or Christmas. Something, you know, is a little off. So we do have to be more and more selective in what we see. But when we're talking about this judgment coming, I said the police state is increasing and the hopelessness, the despair. Now, either there are some murders involved in this or it is despair with the life view. Because if we don't have anything besides what we see around us in life, how could any of us survive?
True.
You know,
yes.
You and I have been talking to someone who has been remarried to a person who has a son who's had a drug problem. And we can see now that that's putting a terrible strain on the marriage of these two. And it's very sad because the man lost his first wife to breast cancer. But these terrible strains and stresses are much more than they would have been 30 or 40 years ago, because Satan is getting the upper hand with the drugs, the corrupt view, and with nothing there that we can cling to. We must get to the Betty Maltz article a little later, The Glimpse of Eternity. But now let's find out about these strange banker deaths from the Fort Fairfield Journal, April 20th, 2014.
Over the past year, a disturbing trend has been developing in the international banking and finance industry. That is, top executives are either committing suicide or being, quote-unquote, suicided, apparently in order to silence them. According to a report by Tyler Durden at www.zerohedge.com, a 14th banker suicide recently occurred in France. Quote, there have been 13 senior financial services executives' deaths around the world this year. But the most notable thing about the sad suicide of the 14th, a 52-year-old banker at France's Bread Banque Populaire, is she is the first female, wrote Durden. And it continues with a quote, as Le Parisien reports, Lydia, no surname given, jumped from the bank's Paris headquarters, 14th floor, shortly before 10 a.m. France TV added that sources said, quote, she questioned her superiors before she questioned, before jumping out the window. But the bank denies it, noting that she had been in therapy for several years. This is the 14th financial services executive death in recent months. The following is a list of all banker deaths compiled by www.zerohedge.com. William Brokesmith, 58-year-old former senior executive at Deutsche Bank AG, was found dead in his home after an apparent suicide in South Kensington in central London, January 26. Carl Slim, 51-year-old Tater Motors managing director, Carl Slim was found dead on the fourth floor of the Shangri-La Hotel in Bangkok on January 27th. Gabrielle McGee, a 39-year-old J.P. Morgan employee, died after falling from the roof of the J.P. Morgan European headquarters in London on January 27th. Mike Duker, 50-year-old chief economist of a U.S. investment bank, was found dead close to the Tacoma Narrows Bridge in Washington State. Richard Talley, the 57-year-old founder of American Tile Services in Centennial, Colorado, was found dead earlier this month after apparently shooting himself with a nail gun. Tim Dickinson, a UK-based communications director at Swiss REAG, also died last month. However, the circumstances surrounding his death are still unknown. Ryan Henry Crane, a 37-year-old executive at J.P. Morgan, died in an alleged suicide just a few weeks ago. No details have been released about his death, aside from this small obituary announcement at the Stanford Daily Voice. Lee Junji, 33-year-old banker in Hong Kong, jumped from the J.P. Morgan HQ in Hong Kong. James Stewart, Jr., former National Bank of Commerce CEO, found dead in Scottsdale, Arizona, the morning of February 19. A family spokesman did not say what caused the death. Edmund Eddie Riley, 47, a trader at Midtown's Vertical Group, committed suicide by jumping in front of the LIRR train. Kenneth Blando, 28, a trader at Levi Capital, formerly investment banking analyst at J.P. Morgan, jumped to his death from his sixth-floor East Side apartment. Jan Peter Schmidtman, 57, the former CEO of Dutch Bank ABN AMRO, found dead at home near Amsterdam with wife and daughter. Lee Juan Hui, 49, director of China's Banking Regulatory Commission, died of a sudden heart attack. Lydia, no last name given, 52, jumped to her suicide from the fourth floor of Bread Bank Populaire in Paris. This trend seems to be reminiscent of the suicides that occurred immediately following the 1929 stock market crash in the U.S., as frantic traders and bankers saw no other way out from beneath a massive stockpile of debt and financial obligations they were saddled with.
And now from David Deschain, Fairfield Journal, April 30th, 2014, Homeland Security purchasing 25 million rounds of shotgun ammo as Obama calls for highest income tax rate in U.S. history. By David Deschain. As presidential impersonator Barack Hussein Obama called for the highest federal income tax rate in U.S. history, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security ramped up efforts to arm itself against the American people by soliciting bids for up to 25 million rounds of shotgun ammunition. According to the Congressional Budget Office, under Obama's proposal, taxes would rise from 17.6% of gross domestic product in 2014 to 19.2% in 2024. During the 10 years from 2015 to 2024, federal taxation would average 18.7% of GDP. And I think we've had a little moratorium on this worst-case scenario. Deschain continues, America has never been subjected to a 10-year stretch of taxation at that level. With the U.S. government growing increasingly out of touch with the needs of the American people and now acting more like an occupational government than a representative government, Americans are beginning to stand up and take notice. A recent standoff at the Nevada cattle ranch of Clive and Bundy brought out nearly 1,000 militia from the general populace across the U.S. who converged on that location to protect Mr. Bundy from the forced confiscation of his cattle by the Bureau of Land Management. This trend toward uprising by the American people against the oppressive, tyrannical U.S. government has not gone unnoticed by the U.S. Department of Homeland, quote, Security, who has commenced the purchase of nearly 2 billion rounds of ammunition over the past 2 years, with millions of rounds of long-range sniper ammunition to be used against the American people.
The solicitation for the shotgun ammo, which is used primarily for close-quarters combat, was posted on FBO.gov. It states that U.S. Customs and Border Protection, a department under DHS, is seeking, quote, Shotgun ammunition for use by all applicable agencies in the Department of Homeland Security, unquote. More specifically, 3 million rounds of shotgun slugs per year and 2 million rounds of buckshot per year for 5 years. In lieu of an active federal police department, the Customs and Border Protection branch of the DHS has been tapped to fill the role as a de facto, federally controlled local law enforcement apparatus in the event local police end up siding with the anticipated uprising. Over the past 10 years, the number of Border Patrol officers has increased by a factor of 10 or more, and the agents find themselves progressively moving further and further inland, away from the border, in order to acclimate the citizenry to their presence and, ultimately, dominance in the event the U.S. government needs to maintain control of their chattel property amidst a general and unstoppable uprising by the U.S. citizenry.
And somewhere we had a little article about the IRS, some of the actual members of the IRS who had owed late taxes were part of a big group that got bonuses.
I remember that.
Remember that? Yes. Pretty shocking, isn't it?
Yep.
But as we go ahead, we can see how this country is changing and really tempting God's judgment. This is now the AFA Journal, May 2014.
Since the repeal of the U.S. military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, oh, and I should say, the title of this is First Ever Drag Show on U.S. Military Base. Since the repeal of the U.S. military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in September 2011, homosexuals in the military have become more open about their sexuality. On March 1st, at Kadena Air Base in Okinawa, Japan, six military personnel, gay, lesbian, and straight, donned makeup and dresses to lip-sync songs such as I Want to Dance with Somebody. The event was a fundraiser for the recently formed Okinawa chapter of OutServe, Service Members Legal Defense Network, the largest nonprofit advocate for the military's LGBT community. About 400 tickets were sold for the event. Performers took stage names such as Chocolate Sunrise and Artemis Foe. The local lesbian performer took the drag king name Manny Nuff. Don't Ask, Don't Tell was the official U.S. policy on homosexuals serving in the military. It was instituted by the Clinton administration in 1994. The policy barred open homosexual persons from military service, but prohibited military personnel from discriminating against or harassing closeted homosexuals.
Lots of things are changing in this country. We've heard someone recently on a talk show talking about the currency reset may be coming, and it might mean, Lou, as much as 50% less value in our money. If it occurred over time, this analyst thought, if it came in one fell swoop, it could be as large as 25%. Your money would buy 25% less than it does now. The ghost of Kinsey continues to haunt public policy. The United Nations often accredits non-governmental organizations to give them credibility, validation, in some instances authority. This again is out of the AFA Journal. But several pro-family organizations are concerned that the United Nations Committee on NGOs is considering the Kinsey Institute for special consultative status with the organization's Economic and Social Council. Wendy Wright, Vice President for Government Relations and Communications for Catholic Family and Human Rights Initiative, said that by accrediting the Kinsey Institute, the UN would be breaking its own rule of not accrediting organizations associated with pedophilia or human rights violations. She said, quote, "The Kinsey Institute was started by Alfred Kinsey, who claimed that children are sexual from infancy, and his primary source for claiming that was adult men who recorded details of their sexual contact with children for his book, Sexual Behaviors in the Human Male. These were criminals, some of them actually in jail, others who had not been caught. The men were paid for their, quote, research." Since the publishing of Kinsey's book in 1948, its influence has only grown. Kinsey successfully lobbied to lessen the penalties for sexual crimes and laid the foundation for the sexual revolution of the 1960s. And we could say that was a big step into this depravity that we have. You're also going to have to worry about your money. And Gary Kaw, in his newsletter, Hope for the World Update, Spring 2004, and you might like to go to his website, Let's see what it is exactly. I think it is Hope for the World. Let me look again. You know, just when you want to find something, you don't see it. But I think it is hopefortheworldprobably.com. Here we are. Website is not that. It is www.garykaw.org. And his name is spelled K-A-H, G-A-R-Y-K-A-H.org. Important things. Now, what to do if you don't have much money? We're going to then get right into the hope that we have eternally with the Betty Maltz story. What to do if you don't have much money?
If your situation is similar to that of ours, the last of your concerns is what to do with a lot of money. Having been in ministry for over 20 years, living month to month while raising a family on a modest income has not afforded us the opportunity to save up any substantial money to invest or even to lay aside for emergencies. Looking after two aging parents has stretched us even further. Many of you can relate. So what might the Lord have lower and middle income Christians do to prepare for difficult times? Actually, one can do a number of things to position one's family for a crisis. In fact, the following suggestions apply to families or individuals of every income category. For the record, our family has implemented each of these steps to varying degrees over the last few years. Therefore, we are not asking anyone to do what we haven't already done ourselves. First of all, don't be a loner. Start or join a small group of like-minded Christian believers with a variety of talents, abilities, and resources, 20 to 30 people or so. The emphasis is on variety because you would need people with a number of different skills to ride out hard times. If everyone in your group is an electrician, but no one knows how to grow and can food, you would be in trouble. Everyone in this group should live within 5 to 10 miles of each other, 15 to 20 miles at most. In the event of an EMP strike, your car wouldn't work. You should therefore be close enough that you could walk or ride your bike to a predetermined location on a country farm where you would meet up with others in your group. Your designated location should have at least a few acres of tillable land for growing food and forest land for firewood, and a freshwater spring, or be near a creek that could be a water source if you have purifiers. Prayerfully develop a group strategy of what each person would bring to the table in the event of a crisis. Then quietly begin making preparations. Purchase a good trail bicycle for every member of your family. Also, owning some silver coins would be a very good idea. They could be used for bartering with other groups. In addition, I recommend that every family have at least two high-quality water purifiers, along with a box of coffee filters. You should always pass dirty water through a coffee filter before pouring it into a purifier. The coffee filter will remove a majority of the impurities, thereby preventing your purifier from clogging up. It will last much longer if you take this extra step. If possible, you should also secure a minimum of 1 to 3 months' worth of pre-packaged, easy-to-prepare food for each member of your family. Keep most of this at your designated location. It needs to have a long shelf life. This, together with your water purifier, would buy you some much-needed time in the event of a crisis. Get together as a group every few months to make sure your plan stays on track. Make adjustments where necessary. Finally, and most importantly, prepare with a mindset of helping others during a crisis. Being in a position of sharing Christ with them if they are unsaved, but also encouraging and helping other believers who ignored the warning signs and were caught off guard, or who, due to circumstances, were unable to prepare.
Yes, in this temporal reality, we do have to think about surviving. And I was incorrect about The Bachelorette being on tonight. It will be on Mondays. But God's time is completely different from ours. His control and His power are immense. We're going to give you part of this article, maybe all of it today, A Glimpse of Eternity by Catherine Marshall, the widow of the chaplain to the U.S. Senate, who was very well respected, Peter Marshall. This appeared in Guidepost, May 1976. Facts are often stranger than fiction, people say. True. Still, many are going to find the facts of Betty Maltz's story difficult to believe. It's a story I can vouch for. Last October, in the living room of our Virginia farm, I heard this extraordinary adventure from Betty's own lips. Through subsequent weeks, I investigated the details in depth. But that day at the farm, I knew that the best and final proof was Betty Maltz herself, along with her 9-year-old daughter, April Dawn, born after her mother's, quote, death, both so vibrantly alive. The adventure began one June night in 1959. Betty, 29, her husband John, a salesman for the Sun Oil Company in Indiana, their daughter Brenda, Betty's parents, the Glenn Perkinses, and her little brother had just arrived for a 2-week family vacation at Gulf Vista Retreat, Florida. They spent that first day swimming, water skiing, surfing, shell hunting. Exhausted, Betty and her husband went to bed early. Then the pain began. Hand pressed on her stomach, Betty Maltz wondered, what did I eat for dinner? Then as the pain increased, she thought, what a way to start our vacation. Finally, Betty turned on the light and woke her husband. When the pain became excruciating, he drove her to the hospital. Betty lay in the hospital several days while the doctors made dozens of tests and debated her situation. Finally, she was sent by plane to a hospital in her hometown of Terre Haute, Indiana, where on the 11th day of her illness, she was operated on by a gynecologist surgeon. He found an appendix long ruptured with a huge mass of gangrene in her abdomen. Every organ was coated.
I can give you no hope, the surgeon told her husband and her parents. I've lost 200-pound men in 48 hours with a fraction of the gangrene we have here. She can live only a few hours. But Betty did not die that night, nor the next. In fact, on the fourth day, she lapsed into a coma. She was to be in that coma for most of the next month. The days passed. 10, 20. Betty was given multiple blood transfusions. She had B-negative blood, and intravenously fed. Not a mouthful of food passed her lips. Meanwhile, two more operations followed. Betty's husband took time off from his business to maintain a constant vigil in her room, checking reports, seeking every possible avenue of hope. Her father, a clergyman, stood by her bed every day, his voice raised in praise and worship of the Lord. More days passed, 25, 30. The doctors were certain that the comatose patient could see or hear nothing. That was not the case, Betty Maltz told me during our interview. All that time that I was a prisoner of my own body, when I couldn't speak, see, or smell, or control the movement of a muscle, I could hear everything the doctors, nurses, and visitors said. It was as though, when my physical senses went, all spiritual senses were sharpened. If people came into my room feeling hopeless about me, I knew it. When they had faith that I would get well, I knew that, and it helped me. If only people could realize, Betty said with great emphasis, that in any form of unconsciousness or coma, even under anesthetics, I do believe, unerringly the spirit picks up those attitudes. Betty described how one day she heard footsteps coming into her room, followed by the pages of a book being turned. When the person quietly began to read a psalm, she recognized the voice of Art, a man she had never liked. In those days, Betty told me, I was a thoroughgoing snob, and God chose this man as his instrument to correct me. As Art read on, Psalm 107, all of it, and then Psalm 108, the words seemed to the helpless woman on the bed to be the most beautiful words she had ever heard. Quote, their soul abhorreth all manner of meat, and they draw near unto the gates of death. Then they cry unto the Lord in their trouble, and he saveth them out of their distresses. He sent his word and healed them, and delivered them from their destructions. And that is from Psalm 107, verses 18 through 20.
To the desperately ill Betty, the word seemed written in fire. She had been handed her lifeline. Betty silently blessed the man whom she had despised. Then came a new crisis. All supplies of B-negative blood in Terre Haute, Indianapolis, and St. Louis had been used. The doctor warned that unless they could find blood plasma for her immediately, Betty would be gone in a few hours. Was it a coincidence that that very morning, Betty's Uncle Jesse, a freight conductor dispatcher for the Pennsylvania Railroad, felt a strange inner prompting that he should leave his job and go immediately to offer his blood? Unacquainted with this kind of guidance, the man argued with the inner voice, "This doesn't make sense. I'm at the end of a run, still miles from home. I don't want to go in my work clothes. I'll wait until late this afternoon until I'm cleaned up. Why, I don't even know if my blood is the right type." But finding no inner peace, the conductor finally dropped what he was doing and headed for the hospital. They discovered that Uncle Jesse had B-negative blood. Once again, the blood transfusion helped Betty rally. On July 31st, Betty's fever shot still higher as pneumonia set in. Then her veins collapsed completely. No more transfusions or intravenous feedings were possible. "The battle is lost," the exhausted family was told. "You'd better get some rest. We'll call you if there's any change." Sadly, Betty's husband drove home, and her parents drove the 31 miles to their home in Clay City. At 2:30 the next morning, Betty's father was sharply awakened. He did not know how. He had a strong compulsion to get to the hospital immediately. He resisted at first. Finally, he gave in, dressed, and was on his way shortly after 4 a.m. Sometime after he had left the house, the telephone rang. It was a nurse calling. "Mrs. Perkins, I'm so sorry to have to give you this message. Your daughter Betty expired a few minutes ago." There was a pause. "I've already called her husband, of course. He will be coming over as soon as possible this morning." Concern for her own husband temporarily overcame Mrs. Perkins's anguished grief. "But my husband is already on his way there. Please have someone watch for him and intercept him. It would be a dreadful shock for him to walk into Betty's room and find her." The nurse promised and hung up. But Betty's father parked at the side of the hospital and slipped in through a nurse's exit door. This next part of the story I heard from Betty's father himself.
Quote, "I walked down the hospital corridor. Everything seemed too quiet, too deserted," he told me. "I remember how my heart skipped a beat as I rounded the corner. I stood in the doorway, saw the still form on the bed. Betty was covered with a sheet. Every bit of apparatus had been removed. All instruments, even the chart, was gone. I was stunned and despairing. I couldn't even pray. I could only stand by the bed, softly crying, 'Jesus, Jesus.' How could the sorrowing man possibly have known the extraordinary adventure his daughter was experiencing at that moment? Let Betty tell it.
I was walking up a steep hill, yet there was no muscular exertion. It was more like a light skipping or floating movement without effort. I thought, why, steep hills have always affected the muscles in the calves of my legs. There was none of that. All movement was a delight. The grass under my feet was a vivid green and of a velvety texture, yet every blade seemed alive. To my right was a high silvery marble wall. To the left, slightly behind me, was a tall angel. I could see only his feet as he walked, and the bottom of his garment swaying as in a gentle breeze. In the near distance were the echoes of multitudes of voices singing, worshiping Jesus. As the angel and I reached the top of the hill, I saw tall, ornate gates, the tops of a scroll-like Gothic design. The gates had a translucent quality, like pearl. There were no handles. No way I could have opened them. The angel stepped forward and pressed his palms against the gate. I stood there for what seemed like a long time, reveling in the wonderful music. The feel of beauty was everywhere. From time to time, I would sing along with the voices in the distance. I remember two of the songs, old, old hymns, "For I Have Been Born Again," and "The Old Account Was Settled Long Ago." Finally, the angel spoke, "Would you like to enter and sing with them?" I answered, "No, I would like to stand here and sing a while, then go back to my family." The angel nodded. I sensed that the choice was mine. Then I was coming back down the grassy slope, and the sun was on my left, coming up over the wall. I remember noticing details like the sharp shadow of the beautiful gates on the wall. It was at that moment that the world of spirit and this world of time and space fused back together for Betty. In her room, the sun was also coming up. Under the sheet, Betty began to feel the rising sun warming her cold body. Despite the sheet over her head, Betty saw moving, wavy letters about 2 inches high go before her like a ticker tape message on the sunbeams. She has no idea whether she was seeing with her spiritual eyes or with her physical eyes. After what she had experienced on the grassy slope, she knew that the one is as real as the other. The letters, Betty told me, seemed composed of translucent ivory, only fluid, moving through the rays of the sun. They stretched all the way from the window past my bed on into the room and read, "I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live." John 11:25. The words were so alive that they pulsated. I knew that I had to touch those living words. When I, by faith, reached up to grasp the words, I pushed the sheet off my face. At that instant, the word literally became life to me. The warmth in the moving letters flowed into my fingers and up my arm. I sat up in bed. I was alive. At first, Betty did not notice her father standing beside her. She had eyes only for the unearthly light in the room, and she began to search for its source. Her first awareness was of the vivid greenness of the grass on the hospital lawn, so beautiful, she thought, and of a black man carrying on his shoulder a case of 7-Up into the building. Into Betty's heart welled a great love for that man. Then at last she noticed her father by her bed. He was standing there stunned, too stunned to cry out or to hug her ecstatically or to shed tears of joy. Rather, he was rooted to the spot, struck dumb with awe before the majesty of the working of God himself. And then, of course, the article goes on to tell how her father asked her to describe what was going on. The nurses and the doctors came streaming in, and they really were asking questions. There had been no breathing, no heartbeat, no blood pressure. Between 20 and 30 minutes had elapsed between the telephone call to Mrs. Perkins and the moment Betty had sat up in bed. Now everybody wanted to see Betty, wanted to hear the story from her own lips. When Betty's own doctor kept shaking his head in disbelief, she would look at him in astonishment. "But I'm alive. I can talk and see and smell and feel. I feel fine. And when do I eat?" Betty had eaten nothing in almost 6 weeks. Her digestive organs had already started to disintegrate. Hesitantly, the doctor authorized giving her an experimental 4 ounces of 7-Up over crushed ice. Betty waited eagerly for the drink. Instead, around noon, a tray was set before her, 2 pork chops, applesauce, cottage cheese, a square of lemon cake with warm sauce, a pot of tea. Hungrily, she ate every morsel, thinking it the most delicious food she had ever tasted. Shortly after that, a flustered nurse rushed in a mobile unit. "I'm going to have to pump out your stomach. You got the wrong tray." "Oh, please," Betty protested as the nurse began uncoiling the tubing. "The food tasted so good. It's staying down fine. Just fine." After the nurse left, Betty lay there speculating on God's sense of humor. Pork chops for the doctor's first experiment. And you know, the next day the doctor came in and had a big talk with her, telling her she'd have a very hard life ahead, that peritonitis and gangrene had disintegrated all her body organs. She might have to wear a bag on her side for elimination. She must never have another child, or this child would be defective. So she thought about all this, but deep within her was the assurance that God doeth all things well, Mark 7:37. Catherine Marshall says over 16 years have gone by. Betty never had to wear a bag. Her eyesight has been better than ever. And any other baby you might have would be deformed. Sitting there at our farm was her delightful daughter, April, 9 years old, who was romping in the yard outside. Nothing ethereal or otherworldly about this healthy little girl. So she said that every day she woke up thanking the Lord. Unfailingly, the dawn breaks, part of the light of the world. Just as unfailing is his love and care for each one of us. Now I know we can trust him utterly, and so can you, listeners. Good night from the Divided Kingdom.